Case number 13-1265 et al. Monroe Energy LLC petitioner versus Environmental Protection Agency. Mr. DeBruin for petitioner Monroe Energy LLC. Mr. Long for petitioners API et al. Ms. Bell and Mr. Link for respondent EPA. And Mr. Zalmans for intervenors NBB et al.
Good morning.
Good morning, Judge Rogers. May it please the court. My name is David DeBruin and I represent Monroe Energy, an independent refiner in Pennsylvania without its own blending facilities. I would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. EPA's rule must be vacated because the agency inexplicably took into account one side of the equation, but not the other, and because the agency's arbitrary rule imposes devastating costs on my client and other obligated parties who, as this court held in API, cannot overcome structural barriers to greater use of renewable fuel. EPA recognized that if it did not utilize its authority to reduce the 2013 volume requirement, utilization of 2012 RINs were essential to enable that 2013 requirement to be met. But in reaching the conclusion that there were adequate numbers of RINs available, EPA failed to consider the corresponding fact that RINs created in 2013 could be carried forward to be used in 2014. This case
was... Well, let's be clear. When you say failed to consider, they did consider it.
Well, Your Honor, they certainly failed to take into account the fact that as many as 3.6 billion RINs could be carried forward from 2013 into 2014.
I mean, you would agree with me, counsel, that they do discuss this question in the final rule.
Your Honor, they do discuss the question, and I would point out that the very first thing that they say, and this is Joint Appendix page 819, is, I quote, "We recognize that in some cases, carryover RINs from 2012 may not be available to an individual obligated party that needs them. The agency thus recognized that it's created a rule for which some parties would not be able to comply."
Well, but you can't take that sentence out of context, can you? EPA goes on to indicate that, at least in its analysis, at best we're talking about, they say, thus only about half of the carryover RINs in existence would need to be made available. And it goes on to talk about prices. It goes on to talk about other compliance options.
Well, several things, Your Honor. First of all, in that critical passage in the opinion, EPA inexplicably says that even if only half of the 2012 RINs would be made available, that statement makes no sense because 2012 RINs expire in 2013.
So, but that sentence, they're talking about what some of the stakeholders were saying. And so they say there are some indications from some stakeholders that those who own carryover RINs in 2013 may opt not to sell them, instead carrying them over to help assure compliance with their own obligations in a future year. So that's 2013 going to 2014.
Correct. But so the agency, to that extent, did recognize the problem, but then it made no analysis of what 2013 RINs would be carried forward. And in fact, the agency simply said, "We cannot know." But the Supreme Court and State Farm recognized that an agency cannot throw up its hand and claim substantial uncertainty as the basis for a rule.
And our court has said, you know, there uncertainty in some of these areas is necessary. But I want to be clear, is your position that your client cannot, or there are insufficient RINs for your client to comply with its obligations in 2013, or that the cost is, what you said a moment ago, devastating, although we have no information in that regard to back up that statement. And then third, that your client is being unfairly disadvantaged since it can't produce its own RINs, and therefore that is simply contrary to what Congress had in mind, and indeed that EPA had stated its understanding of the statutory scheme was in 2007.
Your Honor, it is each of those three things.
Right.
First, we do not know whether Monroe can comply. And EPA, in fact, recognized that some obligated parties may not be able to comply.
So the statute says you can be out of compliance for a year.
Well, that is correct, Your
and
Honor.
And then EPA says there are these other options other than RINs.
That is correct, Your Honor. But it is an escalating problem that will get worse every year. And significantly, Monroe opened toward the end of 2012. It had to register as a party able to register RINs, and it already elected its carry forward in 2012 because it was not able because of EPA's delay in complying in 2012. So the carry forward option in 2013 is not available for Monroe.
Let me be clear, unable to comply because of EPA's delay?
Well, in 2012, Monroe was recently reopened. And so in order to comply with 2012, it had to register with EPA right. as a party authorized to retire RINs. It made that application. There was a delay in allowing Monroe to become registered. And as a result, it was forced to carry forward its one-time every three-year election in 2012.
So that's a different delay. I just want to be clear.
That's correct. All right. All I'm saying is, number one, to your 3 points, we do not know whether Monroe can physically comply in 2013. EPA recognized that some parties may not be able to comply. Second, as to the cost to Monroe is approximately $100 million at current prevailing prices. I recognize that that's not in the record. But again, EPA did note in the rule that RIN prices had astronomically increased.
And in your brief, you acknowledge they've gone down.
Well, they fell down very briefly after the 2014 NPRM
right.
was issued. They've gone back up to 55 cents.
So right, as but we don't have that information, but we do know that once EPA announced or proposed what it was going to do in 2014, couldn't EPA reasonably anticipate that that would free up some RINs?
The point is EPA has not promulgated a rule that ensures that parties can comply. It's stated in the rule that establishing a 2013 compliance deadline before the 2014 final rule was issued would enable obligated parties to comply. But again, as the court knows, the EPA was almost 10 months late. In fact, the 2014 final rule has not been promulgated. The 2013 compliance deadline is approaching and is about to expire. And as a result, parties like Monroe are forced to comply at a market that for the last several months has remained about the same price of 55 cents. Monroe's compliance obligation would be approximately $100 million. EPA recognized in the rule that RIN prices had spiked. They also recognized that those high prices were not what the agency felt was necessary to fulfill the statutory purpose. In fact, EPA stated, and I quote, the cost of the RFS program is driven by the cost of renewable fuels relative to the petroleum fuels they replace. Again, that's Joint Appendix 819. So what EPA stated was the cost of the RIN market is intended to be comparable to the cost of renewable fuel. That would be about 5 cents per gallon, which is the historical RIN price. Instead, we have RIN prices approximately 10 times that amount, proving that there is a scarcity of RINs. EPA, in only one paragraph, notes that high price, doesn't justify that price as necessary to fulfill the statutory purpose, but instead says, we have concluded there's enough RINs, i.e., this price should go away. It hasn't gone away, and in concluding that there are enough RINs, EPA ignored the fact that 3.6 billion RINs could be carried forward into 2014 to fulfill compliance. And as there's an escalating statutory burden, there is a huge incentive on parties to carry those RINs forward to fulfill compliance in 2014, and in fact, in future years as well. That is the side of the equation that the agency simply failed to take into account, and in so doing has imposed massive costs on a party like Monroe without in any way addressing or analyzing those costs and concluding that those costs were necessary to fulfill the statutory purpose. In fact, they are not. There is no greater amount of renewable fuel that was blended or used in 2013 because of those high RIN prices. And EPA noticed that although blends like E85 could allow more renewable fuel to be used, it was so far short of the obligation that technology forcing standard was not implicated here. If I could, I'd like to reserve my time for rebuttal.
Of course. Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Robert Long representing API and AFPM. Let me first say a word about the jurisdictional issue raised in the Rule 28J letter.
As to all of your issues.
The Supreme Court has laid down a bright-line rule that a statute must clearly state that a rule is jurisdictional for it to be jurisdictional. There's no such clear statement in Section 7607D7B, and so this is a requirement that could be waived or forfeited by EPA, and here it very clearly was forfeited. They did not raise the issue in their brief. At page one of their brief, they say the court has jurisdiction under Section 7607B. And this was a case where...
What about our recent decision in UARG?
Well, that was a case where EPA did raise the issue, so it was not waived or forfeited. And we think that's true of the other cases in which the court has said that this is a jurisdictional rule. So we think that was essentially dicta, but in any event, it's been superseded by the Supreme Court's more recent decisions that have to govern here.
So a party can waive an objection to our jurisdiction, which Congress has established?
Well, no.
A party can
waive it if it's not jurisdictional, and we're saying under the Supreme Court's recent decisions, it's not jurisdictional. I will say, if this issue troubles the court, and we recognize there may be a need for something like an Irons footnote, and that there is a time issue here, we would be willing to discuss with EPA. I've just raised it for the first time this morning, so we would need a few days to do this. We might be able to simply agree that we would put these issues into abeyance, as we've already done with the cellulosic issue. And I think that would eliminate the need for the court to decide whether this is jurisdictional. So if that would be helpful, we could explore that and perhaps...
Well, I think if that's a possibility, we would like to know. What's a reasonable time?
And if we could submit a letter within a couple of days, if that's agreeable.
Is that all right?
So on the merits, if we get
so,
to...
Just so we're clear, you will submit a letter before the end of the week?
Yes, before the end of the week.
All right, thank you.
So if we get to the merits, just briefly, what EPA did here was, without any prior notice or an opportunity to comment, they used an updated estimate of the total transportation fuel consumption for the year. And we think in the circumstances that was required notice and an opportunity to be heard.
You don't seem to argue that it was inaccurate in any way, though, was it? Was it accurate? The EIA updated information?
We're not arguing that it's inaccurate, Judge Griffith. We're simply arguing that in this circumstance where we're late because EPA again failed to meet the mandatory deadline that Congress put in the statute to give regulatory certainty. And because of that delay, EPA pulls a, as this court said in another case, a surprise switcheroo, and without any notice, in fact, after saying, you could see on the website, they had deleted the statement that they might use updated data. They'd never done it before. They deleted the statement. So essentially they're saying, because we're late, we're going to surprise you and actually increase your burdens. You haven't had the certainty that Congress said you were entitled to. We're actually now going to use the delay as a reason to give a surprise increase.
Well, if you don't dispute its accuracy, what's the harm then?
Well, the harm, again, Your Honor, is Congress said it's an integral part of this statute that the obligations have to be set by November 30th of each year.
So what would your argument be? Let's imagine they did it in a timely fashion. What's your argument then?
And it would be, and again, this is, you know, they had no, they just put this in a footnote. They had no even acknowledgement that they were changing this. So we would say that because you not adhered to the deadline, you have not provided the regulatory certainty that Congress said the obligated parties are entitled to, this, you should not, in that circumstance, take this decision of using updated data that increases the obligations of the parties in the middle of the year. Instead, you should try to have whatever degree of certainty you're able to obtain in the
circumstances. By a certain date, you're saying, give a certainty by the certain date, and if you miss that deadline, it's too late. Is that the point?
Well, what we're saying is they should have used, there was an estimate that came out in October.
They should have used that.
That was published in the notice of proposed rulemaking. Since we didn't have a final rule, the obligated parties, the best they could do was to go with the proposed rule. And then what happened was in August, so well into the compliance year, suddenly this rule came out, and in a footnote, surprise, there was a new number. And if you were a refiner who did, say, a billion gallons of fuel, which is not that unusual, suddenly you had another over 1 million gallons of RINs. You needed to acquire another million RINs. And that sort of switcheroo in the middle of the year, we think, is just not consistent with Congress's direction.
But isn't it always better to have accurate information? I mean, if the information had proved to be a boon to your client, you would have no complaint because it cuts the other way. Would any other party have a complaint?
Well, I think other things being equal, Judge Pillard, accurate information is always better. But in the context of the small refinery exception, for example, EPA itself has said, and this is a Joint Appendix 822, that they're not going to make adjustments in the middle of the year, even though that would be more accurate for small refineries, because that would be inconsistent. This is, I'm quoting them. That would be inconsistent with statutory text, which requires advance notice and certainty to obligated parties regarding the regulatory.
In that instance, didn't they let you know that if there was going that you were on notice that there might be a change, and what they would do if there was a change? They didn't say there was going to be. They didn't say that they were going to grant the exemption. But if they were to grant the exemption, here's what's going to happen.
I agree with you, Judge Griffith. In the small refinery,
they made an objection to that.
They did give better notice of the small refinery, but I was quoting the general purpose.
I see.
And for the EIA, the updated, there was no notice whatsoever.
Could I just be clear? Your argument is that even had the rule said, when it was proposed, that if EIA or other sources provide updated information, EPA will consider this, that is inconsistent with the statutory scheme as well?
Well, I think that would be a harder case for us, because then we really would have had notice and an opportunity to comment. But I think our comment would have been, just as you say, you shouldn't do that when you're that late.
All right. So your reply brief just takes the position in response to EPA that since it only gave notice as to one of the three items at issue, that was not sufficient. In other words, it talked about cellulosic biofuel.
Which is very different, because EPA has had terrible problems with cellulosic and has continually overestimated it. There had never been any complaint, as far as we can tell, about the total fuel estimate. So this came totally out of left field.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the Court. Today I'll be addressing petitioners' challenges to EPA's decision not to reduce the total renewable fuel volume for 2013. My co-counsel Brian Link will then address the remaining issues in this case. Also with me behind council table is Roland Dubois from EPA's Office of General Counsel.
Maybe you can start by telling why in the world is EPA so egregiously late on this, and why have they been so consistently late? Is it just impossible to do?
Your Honor, I would like to answer that question, but my co-counsel, Brian Link, will be addressing the retroactivity issue.
Okay.
So I will delay it for him to answer that for you.
Okay. I don't think he wanted to use the word delay, but I understand your
point. Okay.
I understand.
The theme of petitioner's argument here is that EPA must minimize the volumes of renewable fuel set by Congress in order to maximize their compliance flexibility under the Renewable Fuel Standards Program. Yet EPA's primary duty under the program is to ensure that certain volumes of renewable fuel set by Congress are met each year. EPA fulfilled this duty when it decided to retain the statutory volume for total renewable fuel. And this decision should be upheld for three reasons. First, EPA's consideration of both projected available renewable fuels and carryover RINs is consistent with the language and purposes of the statute. Second, EPA reasonably accounted for RIN banking in determining not to reduce the statutory volumes. And finally, EPA reasonably considered increases in RIN prices in the final rule.
Where in the statute does it establish that it is lawful for EPA to consider carryover RINs in making decisions about whether to exercise the cellulosic waiver authority?
Your Honor, under the cellulosic waiver authority, unlike other waiver provisions in the Act, that waiver authority does not provide any specific criteria that EPA must use in order to reduce the statutory volumes of advanced biofuel and total renewable fuel.
Tell us in terms of the logic of the statute, the notion that petitioners have brought forward is you're really building in a kind of escalating problem if the compliance, the expected compliance levels or the volumes are based already on a kind of, you know, deficit model. You're digging into reserves, and then you're going to have to dig in deeper to reserves. And so, you know, clearly the RIN system is trying to create a market and create a sort of flexible compliance scheme. But you know, they're making an argument that you should look at fuel availability, but not at RIN availability. How does EPA respond to that?
Well, as EPA discussed in the final rule, 2012 carryover RINs are valid compliance mechanisms under the Act that will be used by obligated parties for compliance in 2013. In addition, EPA considered that obligated parties may bank additional RINs in 2013 for use in 2014.
I know, but that's not the thrust of Judge Pillard's question, is it? I mean, we know what EPA has said, but she's asking where's the statutory authorization to do that?
Or the logic sort of consists. I mean, I understand that the statute doesn't detail the criteria that EPA is supposed to consider in exercising that authority, so you have to construct some way of fulfilling that or deciding whether to employ that waiver authority. But the petitioners have claimed that it's just really inconsistent with the whole project to count RINs instead of counting actual fuel products. And, you know, to the extent that you understand that complaint, I guess the question is, why is that wrong?
Well, Your Honor, we believe that consideration of carryover RINs does fall within EPA's broad discretion under the Act to consider certain factors in determining whether to reduce the statutory volumes. Carryover RINs are a type of renewable fuel that will be used by obligated parties to meet the Act's requirements in 2013.
Maybe another way of getting at it is, do you have a response to their concern that this is getting the industry into an escalating problem or a deeper and deeper hole?
Well, Your Honor, EPA determined that compliance was possible using carryover RINs this year while still allowing parties to carry over additional 2013 RINs into 2014. However, EPA also signaled in this rule that it would consider reducing the statutory volumes based on the escalating volumes in coming years in order to avoid future problems in terms of this RIN deficit. Therefore, petitioner's argument that EPA should have considered maximum RIN banking, which would mean that compliance would be impossible under the Act in 2013, It's also not.
So just let me be clear. Are you stepping away from EPA's analysis in the final rule as to the justification for use consideration of RINs? In other words, it's not expressly provided for in the statute, but EPA suggests it is contemplated by the statute for specific reasons it sets forth in the final rule.
No, Your Honor, we still believe that EPA did reasonably consider the use of 2012 carryover RINs in determining whether the statutory volumes were achievable.
That's your conclusion. I'm trying to get the rationale for your conclusion. So in the final rule, EPA says that the program did contemplate market circumstances might cause reduction in production, and therefore RINs would be necessary to fulfill obligations.
Yes, we are not backing away from that rationale, Your Honor. The rule did contemplate that carryover RINs would be available to address fluctuations in supply and demand, and that's also what's happening here.
So where did you talk about 2013 RIN banking? Where in the rule is that discussed?
The RIN banking discussion, although not entirely clear in the record, is talked about on Joint Appendix 819.
Well, can you show me where there?
Yes, it's on Joint Appendix 819.
Which column?
In the first column.
Which paragraph?
I believe it's the first paragraph, but let me confirm that. Yes, it's Joint Appendix 819, the first column in the first paragraph.
And that talks about 2013 RIN banking?
Yes, the logic behind the agency's reasoning in this paragraph is that because there were 2.6 billion 2012 carryover RINs available, and only 1.4 billion RINs needed in the worst-case scenario with no additional use of ethanol and E85 or excess production of biodiesel, obligated parties would be free to use 1.2 billion carryover RINs, which would in turn free up that same number of RINs for obligated parties to bank in 2013 to carry over into 2014.
So you're saying it's the logical outgrowth of this, but it doesn't expressly address 2013 RIN banking here. It talks about 2012, right?
Yes, Your Honor, but I think it's correct, that characterization, that it is the logical outgrowth of this calculation.
But you acknowledge it's not clear.
Yes, but we do believe that it's reasonably discernible from this paragraph.
Okay.
Let me address RIN prices quickly. Contrary to petitioner's contention, EPA reasonably considered increases in RIN prices in the final rule. First, EPA considered whether increases in RIN prices were a signal of the approaching blend wall and whether compliance would be difficult with the volumes in 2013. However, EPA determined that first, RIN prices were not an accurate signal that there would not be enough RINs for compliance in 2013. And that second, the increase in compliance costs due to the increase in RIN prices did not negatively affect the overall transportation fuel market in terms of supply or price.
So you heard Monroe Energy's argument this morning. How do you respond?
Well, I think the argument about
how did the agency address its concerns?
Your Honor, the agency considered comments about spikes in RIN prices. It acknowledged that the increases in RIN prices may affect obligated parties in different ways. However, it chose to analyze the prices, primarily the increase in compliance cost, on the effect on the overall domestic market as a whole, not on individual obligated parties.
Do they affect obligated parties in different ways? I mean, for a RIN whose price has spiked is just as valuable to someone who can generate them as it is to someone who has to buy them. The price is the same across the economy now.
Yes, Your Honor. I think that is a good point in terms of undermining this idea of differential compliance costs. For example, Monroe has the option to comply in a way that's as economical as it is for them. So Monroe could comply like an integrated refiner by purchasing the ethanol, separating the RIN, retaining the value of the RIN, and then selling the ethanol.
So they have that transactional cost in addition to the cost of the RIN?
Yes, they do have to make additional contractual arrangements in order to
do
so.
Now, they have
a
cost, not just an arrangement. The RIN is going to cost them more, right? I want to be clear about this. If they have to purchase ethanol, mm-hmm. which, say, is X dollars, in order to get the RIN, which is Y dollars, they're going to have to pay X plus Y, whereas integrated producers only have to pay Y. Is that correct?
No, Your Honor. The RIN price is integrated into the price of the ethanol. So that when a...
So I can purchase ethanol for price Y?
You can, the RIN price is the, or excuse me, the ethanol price is the RIN price plus the renewable fuel cost. The net ethanol cost is what can be gained.
So there is no transaction cost?
I'm not sure I understand your question, Your Honor.
Well, you say it's integrated into, but that makes it sound, and maybe you're correct, but I just don't see that explained. Maybe you can tell me where it's explained so I'm clear that there is no transaction cost. If you have to purchase the ethanol because you're just purchasing the RIN, which is a Y dollar cost, it's not an X plus Y dollar cost.
My point is, Your Honor, that Monroe has multiple compliance options in order to fulfill its obligations. It's not just purchasing RINs on the spot market, which is subject to fluctuations late in the compliance period. They can also purchase renewable fuel, separate the RIN, and then sell that renewable fuel. They can also enter into contract arrangements with blenders to exchange their product for RINs. It's not just that they have to purchase RINs on the spot market in order to comply.
So the way I heard your two sentences, they have to do two things.
No, those are two separate options.
In each sentence, there were two things they had to do. They had to purchase ethanol in order to get the RINs. Mm-hmm.
Yes, and separate
the RIN.
And
you're telling me the price is the same.
This is a different way to acquire the RIN, and they can do so if that method is most economical to them. So they have a range of compliance costs that they, or compliance options that they
can use. So sometimes the market will work in their favor, and sometimes it won't, and that's just the way the system works.
Yes, that's right, Your Honor. The RIN system is a market-based system that gives obligated parties choices. So it's reasonable for EPA does not make these choices. Obligated parties do. So it's reasonable for EPA not to focus on these individual choices or use the nationally applicable statutory volumes in order to mitigate fluctuations in certain compliance choices for certain obligated parties.
Because they've chosen to be in one market position, not as an integrated producer, and if they thought it was a better business decision or a better business model to be blending their own fuel, they could have done that. So there actually are some transaction costs if they said, wait, actually, the way things are going, we shouldn't be an integrated producer. I guess there's a one-time cost there of saying, well, let's change our business model. But your position is that's not the kind of cost that this statute authorizes EPA to take into account.
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor. And let me just emphasize, too, that Monroe, as an independent refiner, isn't in some special position in terms of obligated parties. Importers of conventional fuel are also in the same position in terms of the options that they have in order to comply with the Act. So this dichotomy between integrated refiners and independent refiners is somewhat of an incomplete picture of the obligated parties under the Act. All right. Unless there are any further questions, I'll...
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Brian Link. I'm prepared to address the remaining challenges concerning the decision to apply the RFS standards retroactively to all of the calendar year 2013, as well as API and AFPM's challenges.
Do you concede that the application was, in fact, retroactive?
I believe our position on this was explained at argument in the NPRA case in 2010, and I believe we stated there that there were some retroactive elements of the rule and that those were implicitly authorized by the statute. and reasonably undertaken in the context of that rulemaking. Our position on that is the same here, and we, in fact, believe the NPRA case controls this issue, at least with respect to whether EPA had the implicit authority to do this. Now,
so you'd rather stake your position on this is retroactive, but we have the authority to do it, rather than this is something that applies to a pending course of conduct, it's therefore not retroactive, and on that ground, notice is adequate and prejudice is absent, and we're going forward.
I mean, we noted in our brief that there may be a question of whether at most this fits in the category of secondary retroactivity, which is sort of semantically confusing, but I think essentially comes close to what you're saying, mm-hmm. that not truly retroactive, but simply a question of whether the action is a reasonable one in the context of a particular program. The statute, of course, is one that requires that the percentage standards ensure compliance with the applicable volumes on an average annual basis. So it's very difficult, perhaps impossible, for EPA to establish these standards in a way that's consistent with the statute without making them apply to the entire calendar year.
Well, another way they could do it is by acting timely. Maybe this is the time for Judge Griffiths, Judge Griffiths' question about why exactly has EPA been so late and really created these problems.
I am sure Judge Griffith has been waiting for that answer. If I may, I'd like to go back to 2008 in answering that, because I want to show you that the track record is not as bad as it may have seemed. 2008 was the last annual rule issued under the RFS-1 program. That rule was published in the Federal Register before the deadline. Two other rules, 2011 and 2012. The 2011 was signed prior to the deadline, although it took about a week afterward to publish it in the Federal Register. And then 2012 was signed about 3 weeks after the deadline. So it was late, but not remotely as late as this rule. That leaves two others. The combined 2009 and 10 standards that were reviewed by the court in NPRA and this year's standards. And I think that they have two things in common, that before both rulemakings, there were issues EPA dealt with in those rules that it hadn't had to before. In 2010, there was a broad suite of questions about how the program was going to change. For example, whether they would change the designation of obligated parties, what fuels would qualify under the new regime, whether RINs from the initial program could be used under the new program. So EPA dealt with all those issues, and they took longer than they had for other rules. This year, as everyone has noted, it was the question of the E10 blend wall, not previously a problem because the statutory volumes weren't as high as they have now become this year. EPA dealt with that for the first time, and again, took longer than it had for other rules. Drafted the proposed rule by July of last year, but it took a long time to get through interagency review. Now, this is not the kind of timetable Congress intended, but I think it's fair to say that it is at least understandable that when novel policy issues come up, it does sometimes take longer for the agency to address them. And by the way, this also leads me to a point that's been made a few times here. There's been talk about how this is an escalating problem for the future. That may be, but that would not alone be a reason to set aside this rule. EPA obviously has reserved its decision for next year's rule. It's got a different proposal now. And when that final rule comes out and the court hears it, it may lead to a different result or a different analysis. But that would not be a reason to set aside this rule if it is otherwise reasonable. I'd like to talk a little bit about whether the notice in this rule was reasonable. When the proposal was signed at the end of January 2013, and published shortly thereafter. But from that point on, obligated parties understood that they were likely going to have to comply with the full statutory volumes because EPA was not proposing to reduce them. And EPA specifically said at that time, we've looked at the E10 blend wall. We do not think it requires us to reduce the statutory volumes for the reason my co-counsel explained. In addition, they should have anticipated, even at that time, that the standard would likely apply to the entire calendar year because, again, that's what EPA had done in 2010. When a rule was similarly late, that's the approach the court had upheld. And EPA had not suggested it would change that approach. If I may add one point to that, there is evidence in the record, Joint Appendix 424 to 426, that market researchers already were predicting that RIN prices would likely go up if parties had to comply with the full statutory volumes. And the reason I bring that up is because it was already foreseeable, even before EPA published its proposal, that RINs might be more costly this year. So obligated parties were informed enough that they could decide already in 2012 whether they wanted to acquire additional RINs at the historically low prices then prevailing to reduce their compliance costs this year. Some did, some didn't.
Excuse me, what about the late decision to change the estimate of the total volume of non-renewable fuel in the economy?
I'd like to make three brief points about that. First of all, we don't believe we waived the question that is decided in UARC, that this is precluded from review here because it was raised for the first time in recompetitions that are pending. We argued in our brief very specifically that no comments on this issue were raised despite what we believe to be adequate notice. And we advised the court in a procedural motion at that time that the objections had been raised in recompetition. Now, if the court thinks that was not a clear enough assertion of this defense, we believe that it is jurisdictional. The court recently held that in National Association of Clean Water Agencies. In fact, every circuit to address the issue has agreed with that. And we think that 7607E makes that very clear because it says nothing in this chapter shall be construed to authorize judicial review of regulations or orders of the administrator except as provided in this section. It very clearly speaks in terms of limitations on the court's power to act, and thus it is a jurisdictional restriction. It is also distinct from the statute construed in the Sebelius case, which the court noted did not speak expressly in jurisdictional terms. And if I may make one more point, as you've noted, no one suggests that the updated data was, no one disputes that the updated data was more accurate than if EPA had continued to rely on the October 2012 estimate. No one disputes that EPA accurately took it into account when they recalculated the final standards. No one suggests EPA changed its formula for making those calculations. And, as we showed in our brief, the changes in the percentages are essentially...
Mr. Long's point, or your opponent's point, that at some point there's got to be some line drawn here to give regulated entities some surety of what's going on here. I mean, under the scenario that you've discussed, when EPA has a difficult problem, they can just put it off as a long period of time, interagency reviews, the boogeyman or whatever, they can just put it off as long as they want. And then, on top of that, they can then put new information in. Well, at some point, don't these deadlines mean something, and can't the regulated entities rely on them? Or under your scenario, they don't seem to be able to do that.
I think the NPRA opinion would suggest that to some extent that's a case-by-case judgment, because even though the agency has the implicit authority to still issue the rule when it's beyond the deadline, it does have to do so in a way that's reasonable. And I'm sure that there could be a circumstance where the information in the record would suggest that it was totally unforeseeable what the agency did and that the lateness truly becomes a problem. But we don't think that case is made here.
I'm sorry. What renders this more reasonable? I mean, in, what was it, 09, 10, the 2 years were combined, so there was sort of more time for catch-up. And here the compliance deadline was extended?
The compliance deadline was extended, and in fact, in NPRA, given where that compliance deadline was set, ultimately parties had, I believe, 10.5 months post the promulgation of the final standard in order before they had to comply. And in this rule, they actually got the exact same amount of time, about 10.5 months from the time it was promulgated in mid-August until the end of June 2014, when the deadline hits. And EPA certainly considered and made the decision to extend the compliance deadline in part to minimize the disruption to obligated parties.
Forgive me, but what is actually extended when the compliance deadline is extended? Is it reporting? Is it counting? Is it...
I think it's fair to describe as an accounting exercise, and obviously counsel for petitioners may clarify if they disagree, but parties may engage in the transactions that acquire the sufficient RINs to comply over the course of time. But there is a point at which they need to demonstrate that compliance to EPA, and the deadline to do that is June 30th of this year.
So they can continue to count toward 2012 obligations, transactions that were actually engaged in the first half of 2013?
Well, to the extent that they are carrying over RINs from 2012, those may be part of what are shown in the demonstration of compliance for 2013. So mm-hmm. they may use up to the limits 2012 carryover RINs. They may also be using 2013 RINs that acquired in various ways or generated in various ways to comply with the 2013 obligation. But the accounting documenting that is due by June 30th. Unless you have any other questions, I will
Thank
rest.
Thank you. All right, counsel for interveners.
Good Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. I'm David Selmans on behalf of Respondent Intervenors. In the short time that I have, I'd like to make two points. The first is that while the Court should uphold EPA's decision to enforce the 2013 statutory volumes, we would urge the Court not to address EPA's claim of broad discretion to consider such factors as the ethanol blend wall in deciding whether to waive those volumes. This case asks only whether it was arbitrary and capricious for EPA to enforce the volumes. The Court can answer that without deciding whether the discretion to waive is broad or narrow. In contrast, EPA has indicated in its 2014 Notice of Proposed Rulemaking that it may waive the volumes next year based on, in part, on blend wall considerations. If it does so, then the question of the scope of EPA's discretion to waive will be properly presented, and the Court can decide that issue with the benefit of full contested briefing. For now, we would urge the Court simply to follow the reasoning and language of its prior decision last year in API versus EPA. There, as here, EPA enforced the statutory volume requirements despite the shortfall of cellulosic biofuel because it concluded that there likely were sufficient other renewable fuels to make up the shortfall. This Court upheld that decision based solely on consideration of the available supply without commenting on the scope of EPA's discretion to waive. That is all the Court need and should do here. On the question of adequate supply, I would just add one point to what's been said by the government on that, and that is that, in fact, as we point out on page 3 of our reply brief, that the total renewable fuels produced in 2013 were sufficient to satisfy the 2013 volumes, even without regard to any carryover RINs. We think that's an important fact for the Court to keep in account in rendering this decision. My second point is that if the Court does address the issue of discretion, it should reject EPA's claim of broad waiver discretion because it is inconsistent with the text and structure of the Act. Congress mandated that increasing annual volumes be used and it expected EPA to enforce them. It narrowly cabined EPA's overall discretion to waive to two situations where it could exercise discretion. And those are where there's inadequate domestic supply, not demand, supply, and where there is severe economic or environmental harm. The cellulosic waiver provision adds an additional element. It requires a waiver of just the narrow cellulosic volume when there is inadequate production of that fuel, but it permits, without mandating, reduction of the broader volumes up to the amount of that shortfall. The obvious consideration, as this Court's analysis in API makes clear, we think, the obvious analysis or consideration that governs that limited waiver determination is simply whether there is enough other renewable fuels to make up for that shortfall. It is not an opportunity for EPA to start taking into account considerations that are elsewhere prohibited under the Act for a basis of waiver, issues like demand pressure, which is not part of the consideration. That interpretation that we put forward is the only one that harmonizes all of the waiver provisions. Otherwise, EPA has to rely on the notion that Congress somehow hid in this narrow part of the statute a massive grant of discretion that is inconsistent with the other waiver provisions.
But now, EPA didn't use this reasoning, did they? Do we have a Chenery problem?
Well, again, EPA did not. We think that the Court can deny the petitions here based on the reasoning that EPA did use, which is there was adequate supply, and the Court doesn't need to get into this. Our only point is if the Court does, it should reject EPA's request for broad discretion. The last point I would make is that the entire notion that you're going to waive statutory volumes based on these limitations on the demand side, whether it's higher RIN prices or the notion of infrastructure issues like the so-called blend wall, makes no sense in this context. A weakness in demand should not be the basis for waiving statutory volumes that were designed specifically to overcome and counteract weaknesses in demand. That's what this whole program is about. It's about ensuring production and incentivizing investment in resources, infrastructure, and others to improve and increase and diversify the use of renewable fuels. Higher RIN prices, for example, encourage increase in varied production and use of renewable fuels by sending important signals to both sides of the market. Producers will make more renewables, and obligated parties will have an incentive to invest in infrastructure or other improvements to better use those fuels. The fact that certain obligated parties may not have made those investments with full knowledge all along that these increasing volumes were there is not a reason to waive the volumes. This program is working exactly as Congress intended. Higher RIN prices are not necessarily a reason to waive the volumes. In fact, it's inconsistent with the notion Congress had. I would point to the example and history of advanced biofuels, especially biodiesel, in the way in which the statutory volumes have driven positive market conditions, which includes, by the way, generally higher RIN prices than existed for ethanol consistently throughout this program. And as a result of that, you have increased use and production and diversification of those types of biofuels throughout the economy, far in advance of what was expected by the statute. In sum, Congress was well aware of these types of concerns about the ethanol blend wall and other supposed infrastructure limitations. But it saw the annual volumes and the positive market incentives that they create is the best way to resolve those problems. Waiving the statutory volumes based on those pricing or infrastructure concerns gets it exactly backwards.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
All right, counsel for Monroe Energy, you have a couple of minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to make four brief but important points. First of all, EPA and the interveners argue that there are different ways the parties can comply and that Monroe should have anticipated this problem and should have become a blender. However, from the very first moment the RIN system was set up in 2007, EPA stated in the record, and I quote, that the RIN system, quote, allows renewable fuels market to continue operating according to natural market forces, avoiding the possibility that every single refiner would need to purchase renewable fuel for blending into its own gasoline. The whole purpose of the RIN system was to avoid what now EPA and interveners say we should have anticipated and done, which is to gone out and become a blender.
To be fair, I don't think they really suggested that. That was in response to a hypothetical from me.
Well, but the point is, Your Honor, in their brief, both EPA and interveners make this point, that this is a problem of our own creation that we could have avoided by becoming a blender. The point is, EPA has essentially changed the rules now midstream and said, at least according to DOJ's argument in its brief, you could have avoided this problem had you anticipated and become a blender. The whole purpose...
Or just anticipated.
Well, and as of the new rules of the road, refiners could become blenders, but as EPA originally noticed, that requires changes in infrastructure. It depends on geography. It depends on access to pipelines. There are reasons why it is difficult for some obligated parties to become blenders.
And you had three more points. I don't want to get you.
Yes, thank you. Secondly, in terms of the late promulgation of the rule, again, to be clear, our argument is not that EPA lacks authority. I believe this court in the 2010 rule addressed that. But when the court in the 2010 rule stated that the rule was not impermissibly retroactive, the court looked to the reasonableness of EPA's decision. And here, EPA, in its decision, upheld the late promulgation of the rule, stating that obligated parties would have sufficient time to comply in 2013 because it would issue the 2014 rule in advance of the compliance deadline. And it recognized that the issuance of the 2014 rule would be critical to whether parties essentially would use their RINs or carry forward their RINs. The problem here is up to 3.6 billion RINs in 2013 potentially can be used to satisfy the statutory obligation in 2014. So when Council for Interveners talks about this is a demand-forcing rule, EPA, first of all, did not rely upon that in setting the requirement. And the critical fact is you have to consider 2014. This is a two-year currency that EPA has created. RINs can be used for 2 years. And so given that fact, it makes no sense myopically to consider only 2013 in establishing whether there are enough RINs without considering the fact that 2013 RINs can be carried forward into 2014. And, Your Honor, when you talk about that one key paragraph in the rule, first of all, it is a very confusing paragraph. If you read it, it appears that EPA appears to be saying that only some 2012 RINs will be retired.
It doesn't say that.
And that, of course, makes no sense. But
and, you know, we assume that the agency is not writing nonsense.
I grant that, Your Honor, but I'm just saying that's what the words say.
Now they talk about stakeholders, and the whole paragraph's talking about 2013.
All right. Granted, Your Honor, if you're taken that way, the point is at the end of that paragraph, EPA concludes that there should be at least 1.2 billion RINs left over at the end of 2013, taking 2012 into account. That's 1.2 billion RINs. Because 2013 RINs can be used in 2014, and 3.6 billion would be 20% of the 2014 statutory requirement, and that's the maximum of prior year RINs that can be used, 20%. Even if 1.2 billion RINs are left over, when 3.6 billion RINs can be carried forward, that is almost 2.5 billion RINs short for 2013 compliance.
And so we're all in the realm of speculation here, right? The agency acknowledges there's no way to tell.
Well, there's no way to tell.
So they are focusing on alternatives, what history has shown, what certainty about 2014 can provide. And so the rule, just tell me, the rule you're saying that we should, the rationale we should adopt is that even though the agency made a judgment based on those considerations, it was nonetheless arbitrary and capricious to do so?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Because the fact that there is uncertainty, State Farm at page 52 of the decision recognizes you can't throw up your hands and say substantial uncertainty.
That's what I'm trying to say. I understand you want to characterize it that way, but we've got three columns where, you know, it didn't say, well, we have no idea, and so that's the end of our discussion.
Well, that
I
is.
I mean, we would have to, and maybe we will, but I'm just saying we would have to find that each of the reasons that EPA made, when taken as a whole, show it was arbitrary and capricious.
I agree with that, Your Honor. I agree with that. But there are benchmarks. We do know how many RINs in 2013 can potentially be carried forward for use.
Potentially, and the agency acknowledged that.
Well,
but it says, you know, we don't know and you don't know.
But the point is the agency must set a rule that obligated parties can comply. And here the agency turns around and says, we recognize that some obligated parties cannot comply. How can you set a rule and turn around and say we recognize that some obligated parties cannot comply?
What's your third point?
I wanted to address one last point from Judge Pillard. You asked the question about 2012 RINs. It's important for us to emphasize that even if there had been no 2012 RINs left over, the problem that we are objecting to would have still existed. In other words, you cannot look at 2013 and, you know, the interveners say there were enough RINs created in 2013. If you look at the final end-of-the-year tally, there were enough 2013 RINs to satisfy the 2013 obligation. The problem is that is not sufficient because under the rules the agency has created, it's a two-year currency, some of those 2013 RINs can be carried forward into 2014. And that's what the agency failed to take into account.
So you're saying that the rule has to be read in saying that EPA knew there was no way for all obligated parties to comply, period.
Well, all I'm saying is the agency has to.
But isn't that what you're saying?
No, I don't think so, Your Honor.
All
the
right.
agency has to take into account the reality under its regulatory system.
But it did, and I know you disagree with that reality. That's all I'm trying to understand.
Your Honor, I submit that it recognized it. It talked about high prices, and then it just said, but under our analysis, there will be enough.
It was just conclusory?
Well, it's one paragraph.
I'm trying
paragraph.
To get it
yes.
into our
I think that is correct, Your Honor.
Language.
It is. It's not just conclusory. It's a flawed math. They say prices are high. But under our analysis, there will be enough. That's all they say in that critical paragraph about prices.
So if prices had stayed at 5%, would you still have this argument?
Well, if prices...
No.
No.
I mean, not 5%, 5 cents.
If they had stayed at 5 cents, because that, again, is the price of the renewable fuel relative to petroleum. And EPA, in this rule, on the same page, says that the purpose of the RIN system, the cost of compliance, is to be the difference in the cost of renewable fuel relative to petroleum fuel. And yet that difference, which is 5 cents, is not what the RIN price is, which is 55 cents, which is
my question was, would you be making the same argument if the RIN price was 5 cents?
No, because I think if because that would reflect that there was, in fact, as EPA said, an adequate supply. If the market were not distorted, if prices reflected underlying fundamentals, the market would be operating as EPA intended.
But why isn't that just a challenge to the statutory choice to include a RIN system in the compliance scheme? I mean, it's something that's built in, that's meant to create a certain amount of flexibility, but also a certain amount of market operation, including market risk.
But again, that is not the basis on which EPA upheld the rule. Clearly, EPA said the purpose of the RIN system was to make it easy for obligated parties to comply, so as not to impose the kind of devastating costs on a party like Monroe that, in fact, are happening this year right now as we speak.
So your argument that they acknowledge that it was impossible for you to comply is that it would be expensive for you to comply.
Well, we don't know. Again, the compliance deadline is in June. Whether that market is deep enough to enable us to comply, what the ultimate price will be, whether that price is in some way being depressed by the fact this proceeding is still pending, we don't know.
I know you have one more point, and your 2 minutes is capacious, but can you be specific about what you're actually seeking in terms of relief if we determine that EPA acted unlawfully here?
Yes, we are asking that the rule be vacated, and we are respectfully requesting the court to issue its decision as soon as possible. We sought expedition because the compliance deadline will close on June 30th. As the court knows, there are enormous penalties under this statute if a party fails to comply. So we are trying, on the one hand, to fulfill our obligation, but on the other hand, the prices are exorbitant. And so
that the rule be vacated.
We ask that the rule be vacated. 2013 is done. The amount of renewable fuel that was generated and used in 2013 is done. If the rule is vacated, we would ask EPA to reevaluate the rule, taking into account both sides of the equation, both the 2012 carry forward, but the 2013 carry forward as well. It can decide, as I think the court noted it has done in the past, to treat 2013 and 2014 together. There are various tools the agency can utilize in order to impose a rational scheme that would not impose exorbitant burdens on a party like Monroe that basically had no ability to bring about the structural change that interveners say this whole statute was designed to produce.
And the fourth point in a nutshell?
I think I've made them all in the
all
course
right,
of this discussion.
Fine.
I appreciate the court's indulgence.
Thank you. Counsel for API et al., anything further?
Very briefly, Your Honor, on the issue of waiver at page 1 of the EPA's brief, they concede that the court has jurisdiction. They agreed to the schedule to try to get the June 30th date, so I think if it's waivable, they've waived it. On the issue that the intervener supporting EPA, although really not supporting EPA on this issue, was emphasizing of trying to limit EPA's authority to grant waivers. There is a Chenery problem with that, as Judge Griffith pointed out. That is a very big issue for 2014, where EPA has proposed substantial waivers, and there's evidence in the record that there could be severe damage to the national economy if those waivers are not granted. So we would ask the court not to accept those arguments.
Thank you. All right, we'll take the case under advisement and take a brief recess.